Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is in the so-called fiscal cliff deal with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect, where he has a new article, The Endless Cliff. We will discuss the manufactured and self-inflicted phony crisis we just got through and the next crisis looming over the debt ceiling where, in spite of the president's warning, the wrecking crew in Congress could do some serious damage. Then we'll look into how long the world's only superpower can continue to be the global hegemon when it has such a broken and dysfunctional government. David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Cliff Deal Hollow Victory for the American People, and the end-of-the-year farce on Capitol Hill that produced such a paltry deal instead of a grand bargain. Then finally, on the one-year anniversary of the U.S. exit from Iraq, we will look into growing rebellion in the Sunni Anbar province and the threats by al-Maliki, Iraq's Shiite leader, to use force to put it down. Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq and is the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, joins us. We will discuss how the winner of the Iraq war, Iran, is now losing in Syria, and that defeat could embolden Iraq's restive Sunni population, who are already chafing under al-Maliki's heavy-handed rule. Joining us now is Robert Kuttner, who is co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and the Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. He has a recent article at the Huffington Post, The Zombie Party, and a new article at the American Prospect, The Endless Cliff. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Always a pleasure.
And we have on the progressive side, on the left, a lot of complaints, some of them getting to be sort of ritualistic about Obama caving in unnecessarily. You've got the Nobel economist and New York columnist Paul Krugman talking about Obama being a wimp. But on the other side, you've got some quite shrill Republican voices screaming at the sellout by the Republicans, and people like Charles Krauthammer saying that the Republicans got routed by Obama. Where do you come down on this?
Well, I think you have to divide this into the damage that Obama did in the 2 years prior to this negotiation by really enabling the deficit hysteria, and then the more narrow tactical question of how well he played these negotiations. So let me address both. I think he did a huge amount of damage by pivoting to deficit reduction prematurely, beginning in his 2010 State of the Union address when he appointed the Bowles-Simpson Commission and basically bought the whole story that the way to get economic recovery was to reduce the deficit and reduce the national debt. That's just crazy economics. I mean, when you have a deflated economy, the last thing you want to do is reduce the deficit. You want to get the deficit down over time by getting economic growth back up. And by doing that, he emboldened both the right and the kind of center-right represented by the Pete Peterson corporate fix-the-debt crowd, and he weakened his own bargaining hand. Then, as you head into the election, and he realizes that he's got a winning hand because the so-called fiscal cliff is about to backfire on the Republicans. Part of the so-called fiscal cliff is the fact that the Bush tax cuts expire for everybody. And all he has to do is say to the Republicans, look, guys, I am willing to keep those tax cuts from expiring on the bottom 98%, but I want to raise them on the top 2%. What are you going to do? That jams the Republicans. He also, I think, made a mistake as recently as 2 weeks ago in kind of saying that he was willing to put Social Security into the pot to the extent, at least, of altering the cost of living formula, the so-called chain consumer price index, which was just a backdoor cut in Social Security. He finally backed off that. So, you know, for about a week, he's been playing the kind of hardball that he hasn't played in the past. He took Social Security off the table. He backed away from the whole idea of a grand bargain, and he said to the Republicans, all we're going to do in this deal is we're going to raise taxes on the top 2%, and we're going to put off the sequester, and we're going to put off the threat of not extending the debt ceiling. How did he do? we did pretty well. He kept any budget cuts out of this deal. He had to cave in to some extent on where he drew the line on who would get a tax increase. It went up from 250,000 income to 450,000. That was a cave-in. He did keep Social Security out of the deal, and he did not get in return any kind of a commitment on the debt ceiling, and he was forced to settle for a very short-term delay in the $120 billion sequester of just 60 days. Now, he did say when he came into the briefing room last night after the House passed the deal that he simply was not willing to bargain with Congress on the debt ceiling, implying that if need be, he would use his executive powers under the 14th Amendment just to say that the debt is going to be extended and Congress doesn't get to have any say in that because the money has already been obligated. So how would I rank him? Somewhat improved relative to his complete weakness in the past, but I think the positions that he's taken in the past are going to do a ton of damage in the near future, that Obama is going to have to be an even tougher leader on behalf of progressive principles if he's going to undo the damage. Because 60 days from now, the Republicans get to jam him on the issue of the sequester in the way that he jammed them on the issue of whose taxes shall go up. So he's doing better than he had been, but I think he's done a lot of damage.
Well, Robert Kuttner, when you talk about the deficit hawks and the fix the debt corporate gang, particularly Pete Peterson, and you know, I remember interviewing Maya McGuinness about a year ago, and I'm always polite to people I talk to and call up because, after all, you're inviting people to have a discussion, not to have an argument. But I really had a difficult time with her because she simply wouldn't deal with reality. I kept saying, well, what's this bipartisanship you're talking about? Mitch McConnell vowed to make his number one priority to get rid of Obama. I mean, the notion of, one, that the sky is falling because of the debt, and two, that there's a bipartisan deal to be had, both of those seem to me to be the biggest canards of all.
Yeah, and you put your finger on the fact that the whole Peterson operation and all of the front groups that Peterson finances, beginning with Maya McGuinness's National Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget and Fix the Debt and Third Way and Concord Coalition and about eight other groups, all of these groups camouflage the fact that it's the Republicans who have been, you know, the complete extremists on this by, until this week, refusing to raise anybody's taxes and insisting on the kind of spending cuts that would be bad policy in their own right and would sink the economy in the face of a very severe deflationary recession. But because the corporate types who were underwritten by Peterson want to cut Social Security, want to cut Medicare, want to weaken government, they use deficit reduction as a kind of way of getting rid of these programs or cutting back these programs, and then they use all these front groups as a way of blaming both parties symmetrically, which is also wrong. So it's wrong in the politics, wrong in the economics, and Obama at least some of the time gives them aid and comfort. So now, having won the election, he is trying to be somewhat born again as a tougher leader, as a defender of Social Security and Medicare, as someone who is insisting that we raise taxes on the wealthy so that other people's taxes don't have to go up and so other programs don't have to be cut. But he still buys the snake oil of the proposition that the way to get a recovery going is to reduce the deficit. And that's just crazy. And because of the way this whole thing was structured in the 2011 budget deal, you know, the fiscal cliff has about four different elements. Now, we've just gotten rid of one of them. We're not going to have a tax increase automatically for everybody. We're just going to raise taxes on the top 1%. So on the one hand, that's progress. On the other hand, Obama's given up his strongest leverage against the Republicans, which was that if they didn't agree to tax the rich, everybody's taxes would go up. And now the Republicans are well positioned to turn the tables on him, because if he does nothing, the so-called sequester kicks in, and that's $120 billion of automatic cuts that was postponed 60 days, but the clock is ticking. And so he's going to have to bargain really tough and say to the Republicans, hey, look, if you want this sequester to kick in and have $60 billion a year of cuts in the military, you go right ahead and do it. But I am not going to throw any domestic spending cuts, much less Social Security and Medicare, into this pot. And that would require a much tougher Obama, both tactically and also ideologically, than we've seen in the past. And Obama would also have to say to them, I'm going to stand behind the 14th Amendment, and if you want to refuse to increase the debt ceiling, see you in court.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Cutton, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. And his latest book is A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and the Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And he also has an article at The American Prospect, The Endless Cliff. You listed all of the background to this phony crisis, if you will. But it is a phony crisis. It's been ginned up to make the middle class and the working Americans feel that somehow they have an obligation to solve a problem that is not of their making. The reason we're in trouble is because of what Wall Street did back in 2008, and that's the heart of all of our problems. Now, in terms of doing something about them, I'm a little concerned from what I'm reading about this deal. First of all, the inheritance taxes went up from 35 to 40%, which is not much for the first 5 million. The capital gains only went up to 20%, less than the 39.6% that would have prevailed without a deal. And then, of course, there's been no extension of the payroll tax cut, right? So. And what about carried interest? Are the Mitt Romneys of this world affected? Are they going to pony up a little more?
Well, as you say, that goes up to 20% from 15%. It's not nearly enough.
But they can carry their interest indefinitely. That's a part of the scam, isn't it?
A little more complicated than that. When they take the money as income, at that point, they pay at the capital gains rate, which is 20%. So as long as they don't cash it in, they don't have to pay on it. But when they do take it as income, they pay 20%. Used to be 15%. No, it's not a great deal. It's far from it. And I've been quite critical of Obama. I think he is moving in the right direction, but he's got a long way to go. And I think the Republicans have a lot of bargaining leverage. And as I say, the most constructive thing he could do would be to change his tune on the broadest issue of all, which is whether there needs to be deficit reduction at all, or whether we ought to be taxing the rich and then turning around and spending that money on public infrastructure and other social outlays as a way of getting the economy out of the recession. So, I called my piece The Endless Cliff because far from solving the problem, this was one little aspect. And the Republicans are just going to use all these little time bombs throughout the year to keep the pressure on Obama and the Democrats to cut spending, and they're going to have to be very tough to resist that. Now, the one good thing is that public opinion is not on the Republican side, not on whether to tax the rich, not on whether to cut Social Security and Medicare, not on same-sex marriage, not on gun control. You saw a kind of explosion today where several Republican leaders from states that had been hit by Hurricane Sandy were just outraged at the Republican leadership in Congress for failing to deliver on their promise to schedule an early vote on relief to the states that had so much flood damage. So public opinion is moving against the Republicans on issue after issue after issue. In that respect, Obama has the wind at his back, and again, it depends on whether he's going to follow public opinion or whether he's going to lead it.
Well, and also, the Republicans could be turning on themselves, isn't it? Public opinion may be turning against it, but they may be turning on themselves in the House.
That's right.
With 85 having voted for this package and 150 against it, assuming that the 150 that voted against it will vote for Eric Cantor to be the new Speaker, which is not unlikely, there's going to be a battle there, don't you think?
Well, it's certainly true that it has split the Republican Party down the middle between the ideologues on the one hand and the relative pragmatists, or at least the people who have to worry about getting elected. I mean, a lot of the Republicans have totally safe seats, right, and they don't really care what the rest of the country thinks. They get elected from very right-wing districts that have either been gerrymandered or just represent a part of the country that is right-wing. And so what they're doing is they're painting the Republicans into a corner nationally where they're more and more isolated from the majority of public opinion. So, yes, that's another very useful thing from Obama's point of view, is that it splits the Republican Party. And if you listen to right-wing talk radio and Fox over the last 24 hours, they're very, very upset with the Republicans who voted for this deal. And yet, if you look at the Senate, where, you know, you do have to get elected statewide, only five Republicans voted against this.
Sure. Well, Robert Kuttner, I thank you so
much. Satisfying.
Right. I thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Happy to be with you. It's always a pleasure.
And Happy New Year to you.
And to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. He's the author of 8 books, including A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and the Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And he has an article at The American Prospect, The Endless Cliff. We're going to take a brief station break and be back further, talking further about the fiscal cliff deal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book is Power, Inc., and he has an article at CNN, Cliff Deal, Hollow Victory for the American People. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
And you, in your article, you described the deal. The deal, quoting, "The deal that was hastily cobbled together actually increases our deficit, and it creates an even bigger potential crisis just weeks from now. That said, other than its lack of vision, creativity, accountability, sense of responsibility, courage, basic math skills, wisdom, or competence, this deal is not bad." I mean, I guess it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it, to be living in the world's only superpower with a dysfunctional government?
Well, it's sure no way to run a superpower, and it's also the only way to stop being one. We have a government that can't do the minimum basic requirement of a government, which is manage finances so that we can allocate resources, so that we can provide essential services, so that we can invest where we need to invest. These guys can't even get in the room, set aside their partisan differences, and focus on a couple of basic priorities. We're not talking about ephemeral issues. We're not talking about secondary issues. We're not talking about areas that are, you know, special interest issues. We're just talking about the thing that they ought to be doing month in and month out. If people behave like this in a company, they'd be canned. Who would hire people to be responsible for, spending that's 20%+ of our GDP, who can't do the math?
Well, but the argument on the other, to counter this, surely, is that as much as you can argue that we need a new government or a responsive government or a competent government or a government that actually does its job, and as you point out, if the rest of us behaved like they did, we'd have all been fired long ago. But the American people did vote for this obstructionist House, and they voted for Obama not in equal numbers, obviously, but enough people voted to give the Republicans the power in the House that they have. And, you know, you can argue about the gerrymandering, which is certainly a component. But let's face it, the American people sent a mixed signal in the last election, did they not?
They did. The American people deserve a large portion of the blame. At the end of the day, in our system, they're the boss. Unfortunately, unlike a football team or CEO of a company, we can't fire the boss in this particular case. We have to ask ourselves why a system that has worked fairly well for most of American history isn't working now, is not translating the will of those people into a functioning system. And so then when you get down to the next level, look at, you say they returned a Republican House. Well, we now have a system where, because of gerrymandering in the House, incumbents almost always win. You know, Ronald Reagan observed, you know, in the 80s that we returned more people to office in our Congress, incumbents to office, than happened in the Supreme Soviet in the old Soviet Union. So, you know, the system is rigged so that there are blue districts and there are red districts, and this has a bunch of negative effects. The incumbents don't lose. The general elections don't matter. Only the primaries matter. The only people who vote in primaries are, you know, sort of extreme activist groups within each party. So you get more extreme candidates, which, you know, builds a gap, which is then institutionalized by the system. So it's not just the people. It's that the people have allowed a system to develop that calcifies or locks into place these dysfunctional processes. And the same is true on the Senate side, where, you know, a bunch of customs that aren't in the Constitution anywhere have created, you know, sort of real roadblocks to collaboration, like the fact that in the 1970s, something like 8% of votes in the Senate involved invoking the filibuster rule, and now it's 80%, which means you need a supermajority to get things done. And then add into that campaign finance laws that essentially allow jobs to go to the people with the best connections to the most money and put special interests in the driver's seat in terms of picking who even gets to run, who even qualifies to have enough money to run in these campaigns. You got a system that is never going to represent the will of the American people best, and you get outcomes like this.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large at Foreign Policy magazine. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment and the author of The Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. And his latest book is Power, Inc. He also has an article at CNN, Cliff Deal, Hollow Victory for the American People. So, This crisis, though, it was largely an invented crisis. I think maybe Ben Bernanke actually came up with it, but there's no question that, to my mind at least, David Rothkopf, that the very people, or some of the people who created the real crisis in the first place, which was the 2008 meltdown on Wall Street that took the global economy to a near-death experience, and we still are not recovering from it. People like Pete Peterson are running around, you know, talking about the sky is falling. So there's a constituency out there that essentially wants to create this sense of crisis in the minds of the American people, that really the obligation for American working Americans and the American middle class is to solve a problem created by Wall Street.
I think the working Americans end up footing the bill for these problems that are created by Wall Street. And, you know, even with, you know, all the huzzas yesterday from, you know, people trying to find a victory in all of this, that we'd somehow now started to tax the rich. Of course, we're not going against after carried interests or the the real ways that the really rich keep their money, and we gave them a big bonus by extending in a variety of ways that suit their interests the inheritance taxes. Most really rich people don't make most of their money off of income, earned income. They make it off of dividends and other kinds of things. This just didn't address any of the real things that are driving inequality in the United States. And what's more, we knew this was coming. First of all, they cooked this problem up. And then both parties proceeded to do nothing about it throughout the election season, putting the campaign first, and then getting to this seriously just a couple of weeks after the campaign. And then the president says last night, well, we didn't have enough time for a grand bargain. Well, that's just nonsense. We had months and months and months to have a grand bargain. Nobody even proposed a genuine grand bargain.
Well, it looks like both sides are really playing, playing to the choir, or at least to the bleachers. They're posturing without doing their job. And the president, in his press conference today, since this so-called fiscal cliff deal, which has clearly split the House Republicans, he's warning that he won't play ball on the next one. Which is the very crisis that you're concerned about, David Rothkopf, and that is that coming at about the same time will be the debt ceiling and the postponed sequester debate. So if the president's saying he's not going to play ball, what does that mean? He's going to resort to the 14th Amendment?
No, it's just barroom posturing. This is just, both sides puffing up their chests and saying, I'm not going to do this. And of course, when Wall Street slaps them around the face, as they did the last time we played a ridiculous game with the debt ceiling, they'll come up with some other solution. And it'll be just like this solution. Minimal progress on cuts, minimal progress in addressing the fiscal deficit, zero progress in addressing the much, much bigger retirement health care deficit, which may be $70 trillion, maybe five or so times bigger than the national debt, and punting big decisions off into the future, which is what these guys do best. It's all about the next election. It's all about serving the special interest groups. It's all about how this appears optically, to their bases via cable news filters, and it's not about solving these problems in a serious way. The president, and I'm a Democrat, was the guy who said, let's get Simpson-Bowles together. He got a perfectly good plan presented to him by a bipartisan commission and did nothing with it. The Democrats don't pass budgets in the Senate. The Republicans block everything in the House of Representatives. And they both talk smack to each other like this is a high school, basketball game or something like that, and not, something that pertains to the well-being of 300 million people.
Well, it would seem that you have to add to that the fact that there's going to be even, I think, looming fratricide within the Republican Party in the House, is there not? I mean,
couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of guys, but yeah. I mean, there's clearly divisions within the Republican Party. Washington insiders were buzzing yesterday. Well, Rubio voted against this, and Ryan voted for it, and that's laying down the line for the 2016 presidential debates and the Republican primaries. It's like, holy mackerel, are we in 2016 already? I mean, we could barely stand 2 days like the last two, and they're already 4 years ahead of us. This system is focused everywhere but on the ball.
And in terms of the fratricide, though, in the House, if only 85 Republicans joined the Democrats, and the vote for the new speakership comes up in 2 days' time, it would seem that if you just do the math, twice as many House Republicans voted against this so-called fiscal cliff deal than voted for it, which would give Eric Cantor a 2-to-1 advantage over John Boehner if he's going to challenge him.
Well, woe to America if that's what happens, because John Boehner, for all of his weaknesses, and Lord knows he's got plenty, all you have to do is listen to Chris Christie tear him a new one because of, you know, this decision not to pass aid for Hurricane Sandy victims last night, which is almost unimaginably stupid. But at least he was talking to the other side. You know, Cantor is one of these guys who is all about the combat, all about a zero-sum game, can't think of, you know, outcomes in which both sides benefit. That would make it much harder to reach an effective deal, or even, you know, make it, you know, possible that we wouldn't reach a deal the next cliff, which, by, you know, creative powers of this particular Congress, is a much more serious and steeper one than even the one we just, you know, avoided in the past 48 hours.
Just to summarize the situation, David Rothkopf, there's going to be more cliffs, and coming up soon there's this double whammy where we'll have another Tea Party tantrum over the debt ceiling, and they'll use that as leverage. They say that it's all about leverage, and the punditry and the press go along with this gamesmanship. This whole thing was about, well, the president has some leverage because of the sequester, and now he doesn't have leverage. And so you've got them, you know, playing these kind of hostage games with the American economy. The last time around, which created the very situation we're in, when the Tea Party threatened the good full faith and credit of the U.S. Government, the cost of the debt went up. There's no way in the world these guys can pretend that they care about the deficit when they're running up the interest rates, which then add to the deficit because of the extra cost of servicing the debt. So the whole thing is kind of an Alice in Wonderland and insanity to it. But just to deal with the real core driver of out of control cost, which is medical cost that you alluded to, is there anything in what Obama's done with so-called Obamacare that's going to make any difference? I mean, is anybody really doing anything about the things that are really driving our deficits?
No. I mean, you know, it would be the easiest, most natural thing in the world to raise the retirement age, or to limit benefits to people above a certain income level, or to go to a single-payer system like every other developed nation in the world has done. And we are the only country in the OECD that does not have a national health care system. That is, you know, we wear it as a badge of honor. But, you know, when you look at what it's doing to our country, you could also say this is the height of stupidity. Every other country in the world has realized that's the only way to go. It's the only way to get the efficiencies that are needed in a society where people are living longer in retirement. Healthcare for the elderly is extremely costly, and we're not having a serious discussion about it because that's absolutely verboten to the Democrats. The Republicans, meanwhile, say, well, you can't touch defense spending, even though we've got a defense budget that is as big as the next 17 countries in the world combined, almost all of whom are our allies. In other words, you know, the largest country that might be construed to be a potential rival of us has a defense budget that's 1/15 of our defense budget. This is lunacy. And yet, for all of our adult lives, the number one discretionary spending choice made by the American people via their Congress is to invest more in defense. You can't get here. You can't get to a solution without major reforms in entitlements, major reforms in defense spending, more revenue, probably a value-added tax or some major source of new revenue. Could be a carbon tax or something. That might be a helpful way to kill a couple of birds with one stone. And yet, you can't get both sides to keep all three of these simple ideas in their head.
And at the end of the day, unless the American people demand better politicians, they're going to get what they get. And it's not just how bad the politicians in Washington are. It is, as we pointed out earlier, they're sent there by the people who vote them in and send these mixed signals. So,
and who don't demand campaign finance reform, who don't demand gerrymandering reform, who don't demand filibuster reform, who don't demand performance. We have, you know, talk about dumbing down in American schools and lowering expectations for our students, killing our education system. Lowering expectations for our politicians is killing our government.
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, David Rothkopf, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also the president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power and Superclass, the Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book is Power, Inc., and he has an article at CNN, Cliff Deal, Hollow Victory for the American People. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Iraq looks like it's about to fall apart.
Bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went by, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, cause I'm busted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfuss.
Thanks very much.
And we're speaking, Robert, on the one-year anniversary when Iraqis celebrated Iraq Day with the departure of U.S. troops on December 31st, 2011. And one year later, it's beginning to look like Iraq could be coming apart at the seams.
Well, I hope you're not trying to make the point that the United States should have stayed around in Iraq or else it would have come apart at the seams. That was kind of the conservative argument during the late Bush years and the early Obama years. In fact, Iraq has been coming apart ever since we removed the cornerstone of Iraq, which was Saddam Hussein's government back in 2003. And ever since then, it's fractured along ethnic and sectarian lines, and a lot of its neighbors have intervened, and it verged on civil war for several years in 2006 and 2007. And so it's still a mess. It was a mess years ago, and it's a mess now, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better.
Well, I'm reminded of what Colin Powell apparently told President Bush, who was not given any dissenting opinions by anybody, and for reasons I'm still mystified by, his own father did not weigh in. Brent Scowcroft, his father's national security advisor, desperately understood the mistake that the neocons and the Bush administration, most largely led by Dick Cheney, were about to make. But Bush got no counsel to warn him, except what Colin Powell apparently said, using the pottery barn analogy, if you break it, you own it. So we broke Iraq, but we left it in pieces, and who owns it now? As far as I can tell, Iran owns it.
But we don't own it, so really it wasn't Pottery Barn. And by the way, Pottery Barn doesn't actually have that rule. If you go into a Pottery Barn and break something, they'll say, oh, I'm sorry, that's happened, and they'll clean it up, but you don't have to buy it. So even Colin Powell was wrong about the Pottery Barn rule. Iraq is a fractured state. We broke all the institutions of power. We shattered the economy, we destroyed the army, we destroyed the Ba'ath Party, we shut down all the ministries, and really they didn't get rebuilt properly. And so Iraq is a catastrophe, and
it'll take a generation to recover from the damage of the, you know, almost 10-year-long war that happened there. And what we see happening now is the consolidation of power by sort of a pro-Iranian government under Prime Minister Maliki, who spent years living in Iran, whose party was supported by Iran for decades before the U.S. Invasion, going back to the 1970s. Maliki is doing what most leaders in a vacuum do in a former authoritarian state. He's aggregating power to himself, and he's one by one systematically trying to knock off his rivals, but really not having all that much success, because the Kurdish parties to the north and east of Iraq are really armed and have their own military and paramilitary forces and aren't submitting to rule by Baghdad. And the Sunni, not quite warlords, but powers in the western part of Iraq are growing increasingly angry about Maliki's efforts to imprison or accuse or repress their various leaders, including, you know, the finance minister and the vice president and others who were opponents of Maliki. And now the Sunnis in Iraq are emboldened by the fact that a religiously based insurgency is gaining momentum next door in Syria. And so there's a lot of cross-pollination between the Syrian revolt and the revolt of the Sunnis in Iraq. And both of them, in turn, draw strength from folks in the Arab Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and others that are, you know, funneling money and support and weapons to the Sunnis in both of these countries. So it's a very dangerous situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. So your point's well taken that we shouldn't tie in the withdrawal of the United States to the fact that Iraq is falling apart. We broke it, and if anybody ended up owning it, it's Iran. But now Iran is watching its major foreign policy success in Syria. Iran's essentially losing its grip there, or the Assad family seem to be losing their grip. And this will, and you mentioned that this is emboldening the Sunni in the west of Anbar province of Iraq. There's been a series of demonstrations now in Anbar province by the Sunnis because of Maliki's order to arrest the finance minister. Even the Shia leader, Muqtada al-Sadr, has gone and held a press conference yesterday criticizing Maliki's government for not responding to the people and even saying that he would go to Anbar to join in the demonstrations. And obviously, he's a kind of wily character and not at all trustworthy. But surely this indicates that this government that we've helped put in there, Maliki's government, is completely unresponsive to the public. He's consolidating power. And what's happening to all that oil revenue? Where's it going? There's no evidence that the condition and the lives of the average Iraqis are going anywhere but down.
There's a whole bunch of interrelated issues here. Maliki is certainly in the last, you know, year or two, taken a number of steps that indicate that he's moving closer to Iran. He's integrated some fairly radical Shiite militia groups, really terrorist groups, into his political establishment. He's released a number of people, including a guy named Dakduk, who was an outright terrorist and supporter of Hezbollah, from prison. He's allowed Iran to transit Iraq in bringing supplies to Assad, even though the United States put a lot of pressure on Iran not to release Dakhtuk and not to allow the Iranians to use, you know, overflight of Iraq to supply Assad. All things being equal, I think Iran would find it difficult to control Iraq as Iraq began to develop its own oil industry and its own independence, because Iraqi nationalism would start to assert itself. But problem is, Iraq is caught between all these conflicting crises, and in order to bolster his position, I think Maliki, rather than you know, trying to act as a nationalist, which he flirted with a couple of years ago, is now moving closer to Iran, and I think he'll move even closer to Iran as the crisis in Syria moves into its end game. So Iraq, you know, has the potential to be independent because of its oil, because it can produce a vast amount of oil exports, which can allow Iraq to develop countries, ties with countries like, let's say, China and India and others who might want to buy Iraqi oil independently of the United States, even Japan and other countries. So Iraq has a lot of potential, but it's not capitalizing on that potential because it's caught, you know, in between a lot of big powers that are trying to, you know, gain, I guess, hegemony in the region. And the biggest conflict of all is between Iran and the United States. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in the next year or so. I am quite sure that Obama, President Obama, does not want war with Iran, and I'm sure that he will work, I think, fairly hard to reach an agreement with Iran, although it may take a year or two. That's something that alarms some of the other countries in the region, like Saudi Arabia, and so they're angling to increase their leverage so that the United States doesn't make a deal with Iran that would work, you know, against their influence. And again, Iraq is sort of caught in the middle of all of that. Same thing with Turkey, which is a very powerful country, both economically and militarily in the region. It's a NATO member, and it has a great deal of concern about Iraq and the problem of the Kurds, because the Kurds have a huge presence inside Turkey and the southeast part of that country. So it's a huge regional tangle, and I think it would be enormously useful if the United States and Iran could come to some sort of agreement, because that would then ease a lot of the pressure and the motives for conflict throughout that whole part of the world.
But there's two questions that still remain. What's happening to the oil revenues that are coming in now? And even if the U.S. makes a deal with Iran, Iraq could start to unravel, which it appears to be starting to do, if the Assads fall and you have a Muslim Brotherhood government in Syria that's friendly towards the Sunnis in Anbar province. You've already got the Kurds wanting to have go their own way, and they've got their own oil. They seem to have sovereignty over the oil there. There's also oil, I believe, in Anbar, or at least potential. It seems like it's heading towards balkanization, even if the United States and Iran
That's
make a deal.
That's a worst-case scenario. I mean, certainly the whole region could begin to be embroiled in a very complicated ethnic and sectarian conflict that would spill over into Lebanon, into Turkey, of course, Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. Let's hope, you know, God forbid that doesn't happen. As far as what's happened to Iraq's oil revenue, I mean, oil revenue for Iraq and for many countries like that are oil producers is the prime, you know, sort of underpinning of their entire economy. So what they're doing with their oil revenue is they're using it to pay for imports of everything that they need, from military supplies to basic, you know, foods and medicines that they import, to technology and infrastructure needs, especially, by the way, for the oil industry. They need tens of billions, probably $100 billion, to rebuild and expand their oil industry in terms of, you know, pipelines and refineries and new wells and shipping terminals and everything else, if they're going to expand oil production from whatever it is now, about 2.5 million barrels a day, to up to 10 million barrels a day. They could have a fourfold increase in oil exports over the next 10 or 15 years. And so, you know, don't forget, this is a very poor country whose economy has been shattered. So what are they doing with their oil revenue? I mean, my goodness, they're trying to rebuild the country, which has been devastated, and it's beyond their capacity.
And presumably the country that devastated their country, the United States, in a war that looks like the Americans lost, the Iraqis lost, and perhaps the Iranians won. Are they ponying up and helping rebuild this country?
Well, I don't know if the United States is particularly wanted there, but certainly there are a number of American companies that are involved. It just, Iraq on its own, despite having oil revenues, as I said, is still a poor country. So unless it's going to get aid and charity, which is not too likely, it's just limping by here. It's not some great booming recovery economy. And so that's why I say it's going to take many, many years for Iraq to get to the point where its economy is back on track. The United States and anybody else is not going to come in there and help. I mean, we've left, and the rest of the coalition is gone, and Iraq is now on its own. And as a country trying to, you know, scramble by on its own, it's having a great amount of difficulty.
And it's certainly forgotten by the United States and by the American people. And there'd be no way in the world that anybody could go to the Hill and ask for money for Iraq at this moment or at any time in the foreseeable future. But nevertheless, it is a year since the United States withdrew, and that's one of the reasons I'm calling you today, Robert Dreyfus, is to get a sense of where we are a year later with these constant bombings and these demonstrations that seem to be getting more intense now in the Sunni areas against the Maliki's crude and sort of clumsy use of power. He's now threatening, al-Maliki's now threatening to use force against the demonstrators.
Well, it's difficult to find a new political balance, and it's hard to see who might be an alternative to Maliki. I mean, they do have a parliamentary system, and so it's not a dictatorship. It is a fledgling democracy, let's call it. If there were a majority in the parliament that would comprise, you know, the Kurds, let's say, and the Sunnis, and Muqtada al-Sadr's forces, among them, they have enough votes in parliament to have a vote of no confidence against Maliki and to force him to resign. Problem is, those various opponents of his can't agree among themselves and would also have great difficulty finding somebody to replace him. In other words, once we get rid of Maliki, what then? It certainly couldn't be a Kurdish prime minister, couldn't be a Sunni, so it would have to be a Shiite prime minister because they represent, two-thirds of the country are Shiite. And then you get down to people like Ayad Alawi, who is a Shiite, who has a lot of support among the Sunnis, but he is not too popular these days. There's a former prime minister who came before Maliki who might be a candidate. You couldn't find someone who would be anti-Iranian because the Iranians would probably act pretty forcefully to undermine that person. So it's a very difficult political situation, and that's why Maliki has been able to survive so long. He's ironically had the support of both Iran and the United States for the past several years, and he, you know, knows how to play that game, so he can keep both Washington and Tehran sort of in his corner, because there doesn't seem to be an immediate alternative.
The Kurdish leader is in Germany now with health problems. They're pretty much independent, and they seem to have their own oil revenues as well. Let's just without being apocalyptic, if these demonstrations continue, if Maliki is, who doesn't appear to be very deft, comes down with a heavy hand, things are likely to go unhinged. But just go forward to what's Iran going to do when they lose Syria and the Anbar Sunnis are emboldened by their brethren who are now would be running Syria. That's a different world we're talking about.
Yeah, and I'm not apocalyptic about it. I mean, certainly there are very dangerous things that could happen here. I think the Iranians have figured out by now that Assad is gone. I think the Russians have concluded that as well. So it's only a matter of time. And so the first thing that both Iran and Russia would do would be to try to work somehow to establish, if not friendly, at least, tolerable relations with a new coalition in Syria. And they're not all crazy Islamists, and they're not all Muslim Brotherhood, and so who knows? I mean, maybe something will emerge out of the ashes in Syria. Let's hope it doesn't go the other direction toward a civil war. Same thing with Iraq. I disagree with you. I think Maliki is quite deft. That's why he's been able to stay in power this long, and he seems to know, how to balance heavy-handed use of force with behind-the-scenes deal-making. And so my guess is it's more likely that Iraq will muddle along than it will dissolve into civil war itself. Iran, let's be hopeful for 2013 that Iran sees its best interest in reaching an accord with the United States, that Obama feels the same way, and that he keeps the lid on Israel, which he seems to have done effectively so far, so that the Israelis don't attack Iran. And as long as he can keep Israel in its box, then he'll have maneuvering room in Washington to try to make a deal with Iran. Certainly he's freer now in the second term to make concessions to Iran, which he may not have been able to do so easily when he was preparing to run for re-election. Now that Obama is re-elected, he has a lot more maneuverability in conceding to Iran, let's say, to allow them to continue to enrich uranium under guidelines and inspections and so forth. And the Iranians, in turn, have a reason to make that kind of deal, too, especially if it can lead to the end of sanctions. And so, before we go all apocalyptic about the whole Middle East is falling apart, let's remember that people who live in those countries have gigantic incentives to avoid going over the cliff. And I think they'll all work pretty hard to make sure that doesn't happen. Let's just hope that the United States, doesn't do anything stupid to make it worse in the next year or two.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Dreyfus.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, who's an investigative journalist who's been writing extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And we spoke, of course, on the anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Stan Misrahi and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.